Welcome to the My Stories podcast, hosted by Michigan Humanities. This podcast shares diverse stories from around Michigan, exploring our uniquely Michigander culture. Now, please enjoy this episode.
Hi, my name is Esty Schlenner, and I am the Programs and Communications Coordinator for Michigan Humanities.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Sierra. I'm a PhD student in Linguistic Anthropology, and I have been writing Michigan Humanities blog since 2020.
And today we are so excited to be joined by Ethereum Brammer. Ethereum is a literary translator and scholar of U.S. Latinx literature, assistant dean and DEI implementation lead for the Rackham Graduate School at the University of Michigan, and a Michigan Humanities board member and upcoming vice chair. But if you would like to, please introduce yourself in your own words.
Sure. Thank you so much, Esty, and thank you, Jennifer, for the invitation. It's a real honor to be able to speak with you both. Esty, thank you for, the very kind introduction as well. I'm not sure how much I can add, except for maybe that I'm also a bilingual children's author. And I think that was kind of a surprise in my career trajectory, but it's been a very pleasant one, and that I enjoy quite a bit.
Yes, thank you, Ethereum. Yeah, one of the things that was more surprising and also inspiring to read in our prior interview for the blog was all of these roles and careers that you have managed to do together, because you haven't given up any of them. And that's truly impressive. And I was surprised to see that you are a children's author. And so we wanted to ask you, how do all these careers intersect? How do you make them all work together?
Yeah, it's a great question, because it seems like a real hodgepodge, right, of kind of random careers and hats that I've worn. And if there's any through line, it actually is diversity, equity, inclusion, right? So it's D&I and or IDEA, if you include accessibility, right? And so, unfortunately, growing up in the 70s and 80s in a migrant farm worker community in Southern California, I didn't see any literature. I wasn't exposed to any literature that sort of reflected my experience or, my community until I went to college. And so with the children's writing, my publisher sort of used that as a way to convince me that I should be writing bilingual children's books. I thought myself as a very serious scholar, and children's writing didn't fit that, right? But when it was framed in that way, that this is about inclusion of, young people's experiences from underrepresented communities, that sort of turned me on to the idea that, yeah, wouldn't it be great had I had exposure to stories from my community when I was in kindergarten or first grade? Like, how would that have changed the way that, I experienced school, and how motivated I would be to, read and read literature? Because it really was kind of a catalyzing event for me in college when I first read Tomás Rivera's Y No Solo Trago La Tierra. I was an engineering major up until that point. And so having finally been exposed to arts and culture and literature that was representative of my community actually was life-changing, right, for me, and it was completely transformative. And so I changed my major from engineering to creative writing, much to the chagrin of my parents, and I did it late in my college career. And so, to be able to be invited to potentially inspire young people at an earlier age, so that they can see themselves reflected in their libraries, in their schools, in the literature that they're taught, was really, really important. But it's also the reason why I dedicate much of my scholarly life and efforts to translation, because specifically, I translate U.S. Latinx writers who tend to be underrepresented and excluded from the study of U.S. literature. And sort of the pretext or the excuse for not including them is because they write in Spanish. And the fact is that Spanish, as one of the colonial European languages, was actually predated, the use of English by decades, almost 100 years, right, in what is now the United States. And so, we have explorer accounts written in Spanish of experiences in what is now Florida, what is now Texas, and what is now California that predate anybody arriving from Europe at Plymouth Rock, right? And so there's a very clear continuity of English writing, in the United States, what is now the United States, But there is also an equally clear continuity of Spanish writing in what is now the United States. And what we get in our textbooks too often, especially in K through 12 education, are almost exclusively those English accounts. And so it excludes a lot of other linguistic communities and the experiences of those communities. And so, you know, that's where I kind of wanted to dedicate my work. It really is about diversity. It's about equity. It's about inclusion. It's about, you know, having people see themselves in curricula and in literature and the experiences of their communities, but also, you know, granting access to others that aren't from that community to understand like the history of the communities that make up our amazingly diverse and beautiful heterogeneous country. And so getting into higher ed administration was another surprise. but the one thing that shouldn't be surprising is that it is specifically in the D&I space, right? And so looking at diversity, equity, inclusion, access, opportunity, you know, creating opportunity for diverse communities to access higher education so that they can have those kind of transformative experiences and go on to hopefully fulfill whatever dreams they have for themselves.
Thank you so much for sharing that. All of your work is very inspiring and important. We also wanted to follow up on the advice that you provided in the blog about how people can get started on their DEI work. So you mentioned that it was important for people to measure their progress at various stages of their journey. We wanted to know in your own experience where you think most organizations or institutions trying to implement DEI efforts most often fall short. What are some common mistakes and how to avoid them or address them?
Yeah, that's a big question. So I'll try to break it up in the best way that I can. And if you've got follow-up questions, just let me know, like even if you have to interrupt me. You know, diversity, equity, inclusion, it's such important work. And I think the biggest first mistake is not to plan. Right. So if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. And so, you know, I'm really happy to be at a place like the University of Michigan that's very intentional about its D&I planning, or again, framed as idea if we include accessibility. Right. So our D&I or idea planning is very intentional. You know, we pursue D&I strategic planning in the same way that we would with our fiscal planning, right, and our program planning evaluation. And so the other thing is, you know, when you talk about strategic planning, you talk about mission and vision and values. And so I think one of the other early pitfalls in this kind of work is imagining diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility as somehow peripheral or somehow marginal to the core values, right, or the core mission of any organization, where it really should be one of the central core values, right? And so, and it should be treated as such and centered in that way. And so, you know, when you are doing the strategic planning kind of work, it's important, you know, to integrate not just a couple of platform items, a couple of action items that speak to diversity, equity, inclusion in kind of a tokenizing way, right, or in a superficial way, but actually look at your mission, look at your vision, look at your values, and like breathe those D&I values into your mission and understand how D&I is your mission, right? Serving even an industry, right? Serving your client base, serving your employees and the people that make your operation run so that everyone feels included. Because the truth is, again, we live in a very heterogeneous society. And so your client base, your customer base, your staff are all from diverse backgrounds, right? So they all deserve to be treated equitably and they all deserve to feel like they belong and are included in your organization. And of course, they deserve the accessibility needs as well and those accommodations. And so making it core, making it central, acknowledging the centrality, right, of the core values around diversity is really, really important. And then like any strategic plan, following through, right? And so I think, you know, you're seeing definitely momentum. You know, I think it's unfortunate that it had to come, or one of the catalyzing events that sort of created this new wave of D&I or idea emphasis, you know, have been the tragic deaths. Often at the hands of police. And so with like George Floyd in Minneapolis, for example, you know, and Breonna Taylor as well, and so many others that have lost their lives tragically. And so it's created this new attention, right? New focus on D&I. And I think, you know, another one of the pitfalls to avoid is being reactive, right? Being reactive to these current events, as tragic as they are. Again, going back to the kind of scholarship I do, this is not new for this country, right? There's a historical through line of these kinds of racialized tragedies and horrors. And so, you know, there's generations of this kind of treatment of marginalized communities. And so it's going to take generations of efforts to transform our society, be more equitable, inclusive. And so having that intentionality, being proactive, doing the strategic planning, following through, looking at your assessment evaluation, creating processes of continuous improvement, you know, justice takes time. It's taken a lot of time and many generations to create the lack of justice we have in this country. And it's going to take just as long to create a truly equitable and just society. And so I think, again, one of the pitfalls is just looking at diversity as compositional diversity. So as long as we have one representative on our board, as long as we have one person on our staff, or as long as we have one student, or we're serving, you know, one community organization that represents some subset of diversity, right, that we can show that we've achieved our goal. And again, that's a very tokenizing, it's a very superficial way of looking at diversity. I hope it's not too worn or too overused as a metaphor, but, you know, in D&I, there's this metaphor about the dance, right? The dance of D&I. And the diversity is just a first step, right? So that's being invited to the dance, the fact that you actually get to go. And so equity is often sort of compared to being able to actually go to the dance floor, like having an equitable opportunity to dance at the dance, you know, drink the punch and enjoy the hors d'oeuvres just like everyone else. And so having, I'd add like accessibility at the same vein, right? That you're able to enter into the dance, you're able to participate in the dance in an equitable or accessible manner. What we really want is real inclusivity, right? Real just and inclusive kind of treatment. And so what does that look like? That means like you're part of the committee that created the dance and planned it, right? You're central to what actually, you know, had to be done behind the scenes to create that space. You're included in, you know, being able to select the songs that are played at the dance so that they reflect like a diversity of musical genres and tastes, right? So that everybody feels included at the dance. And so, you know, again, this is a process. It's not something that you do overnight. And I worry, you know, again, when you're reactive about events like George Floyd's unfortunate murder, that, you know, you check off a D&I box by, you know, appointing a person. And that one person is supposed to shoulder all the weight and responsibility of D&I. It's a very marginalizing, right? It kind of replicates the marginalization. It's a very marginalizing approach to D&I.
That was such a perfect answer, Julie. Thank you. And you know, I think that you are so right in saying that one of the pitfalls is when people see DI work as something separate, just like this thing that lives somewhere outside of the rest of things that we're doing. And then when we asked about it, then, you know, we'll tell you something, we'll tell you some statistics or something. But I think that there is a true challenge in integrating the DI work and in the rest of the story we're telling about ourselves and the rest of the narrative we're telling about the work that we do in different organizations. And also to think that this is beyond a lifetime commitment that we're all making. It's beyond all of us. And it's something that is going to take, like you said, generations to achieve justice. And like you said, justice is not achieved over time. And yeah, and just to be humble to the task that one is taking, that is just not one to be taken for the price of it, or it's just something that it's just going to take too many years. But we do, we are very happy at Machine Humanities because you were recently elected as vice chair for 2023. And we wanted to know about what inspires you about Machine Humanities work and how do you see your growth with Machine Humanities?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm just humbled and honored to have been asked to be on the board at all. And it's just been an incredible pleasure and an amazing experience to work with so many phenomenal board members, but also staff of Michigan Humanities. And so to be a board member through the pandemic was an interesting experience, right? And just to see the creativity and the innovative thinking of Michigan Humanities doing, you know, virtual humanities, digital humanities kind of work, just to make sure, right, that access to arts and humanities and literature was still available, especially at a time when it was so necessary and people felt so, you know, separated and isolated. And so it's an honor and privilege to be able to work with so many committed folks. And, you know, I hope I contribute in a lot of different ways, but of course, diversity, equity, inclusion, accessibility have, you know, been real emphasis with me. One of my first areas of service was on the grants committee. And so that's another place where we can make real impact. Like that's a real E, right, in the DI or idea, right, where we have equitable distribution of funding that goes out to diverse communities to include those voices, right? And so making sure that we're being inclusive in the way that we fund and serve communities across Michigan. And so, you know, I feel like my scholarship and translation and that preparation prepared me well to think about the diversity of such an amazing state like Michigan and how do we make sure all those diverse voices can be heard, right? And so we look at diversity along many dimensions, of course, around racial, ethnic, gender, ability, but also region, right? It's been really amazing to read and evaluate grants from, you know, such an incredible diversity of communities from Detroit to Grand Rapids to Lansing to the Thumb to Petoskey and Sheboygan and the UP, and just look at like all of those voices, all those experiences, and be able to tell the story of, you know, this great state of ours, beginning with, of course, the original three Fire Nations, right, the Anishinaabe people, and being able to support projects that tell the origins, right, of Michigan all the way till now, including things like the Great Migration from the South and everything else that led people here. And so, you know, I think that has been hopefully a consistent area of emphasis of mine. The other thing is, you know, talking about assessment and evaluation that I'm really, really excited about is if you're talking about the dance, right, and we're going to extend that metaphor, you can assess and evaluate every step of that, right? Like, who did you invite to the dance? Did they show up, right? That's D, that's your diversity. Equity, who danced? Who went out to the dance floor, right? Was it accessible? Were people able to access the dance floor that wanted to, right? You can evaluate that. You could assess that. If not, like, what could we do differently and better to make it more accessible and make sure more people have more equitable access to that dance floor? And you can also look at inclusion, right? Who is included in the process? Who is included in the planning? Did we execute D&I in the way that we wanted to, right? Or that we set out to? And so, you know, I think being able to, again, put in a process of continuous improvement. We do this with financial and fiscal responsibility, right? Like, we never imagine that we'll ever have to be not responsible with our funding, right? Like, we don't imagine that future. We never imagine a future where we don't have to manage well our human resources, right? And be attentive to the needs of the folks that run our organization and make it function. And I think we need to center D&I or IDEA in the same space, in the same way. We should never imagine a future where we're done. Like, for those that want to stop talking about diversity, I'm sorry, we're not. It's never going to be done. Why? Because we're always going to be serving heterogeneous communities and we're always going to be working with people that come from different experiences. And so making it central and then using the same kind of operational and evaluative and assessment techniques to make sure that we're always doing it well. In the same way that we're always looking at our budget, we're always making sure that we're being good stewards of funding. In the same way that we're always looking at our HR resources and making sure that folks are happy, they feel like they belong, and they feel like they're included. And that intersects perfectly with D&I, because we need to make sure that our funding resources are being distributed in a way that's equitable, right? That serves the diverse populations that we serve and that people feel like they're included and they belong, including our staff, as well as those that we serve.
Thank you so much for that answer. And I love the metaphor of the dance, and I appreciate you just extending that. I think it worked really well to explain that farther. We are so looking forward to seeing your achievements as vice chair next year. And thank you so much for being here. And if you would like to plug where people can connect with you or like where to purchase your children's books or read them, please feel free to share with us before we go.
Yeah, thank you for embarrassing me in that way. But that certainly was not my intent for this to be a plug for my books. But if folks are interested, they're available for purchase on Amazon or anywhere else that you might order books online. But I've been really blessed to have a great publisher in Arte Público Press that has essentially published every book that I've written for publication. And so you could also go directly to Arte Público Press's website. And, you know, I'm very fortunate and blessed to be able to work at a great institution like the University of Michigan at the Rackham Graduate School. And so if you just go online and look at the University of Michigan and look me up, my last name is Brammer, B-R-A-M-M-E-R, and I should pop up, you know, on the Michigan website or the Rackham website.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to the My Stories podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast streaming service so that you can be alerted when new episodes are released. Follow Michigan Humanities on Facebook and Instagram for exciting news on what's going on in our state. See you next time.